SNL with Amy Adams is over, but we are just getting started here at Post Show Recaps. Hey, everybody, please do not touch your dial or your phone or your iPod or your computer or whatever listening medium you use to listen to these podcasts. I am not Rob Cesternino. My name is Mike Bloom. I am one of the co-hosts in the Rob Has a Podcast Zeitgeist. You might know me from my coverage of Last Comic Standing and Celebrity Apprentice on the main Rob Has a Podcast feed, and from coverage of Once Upon a Time here on Post Show Recaps. But I am covering for the great Rob Cesternino, who is currently over on the other side of the country, away from his podcasting equipment, taking a well-earned break during the holidays. But we are joined, as always, by the one and only Rich Tackenberg. Rich, how you doing?
Mr. Bloom! Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm really excited to have you.
Of course, I have my Christmas sweatpants on, so I'm ready to go.
And are you one of the featured players on SNL? It's very hard for me to keep track.
I am a white guy, so you know what? I would have fit in more with last year's crowd than this year's crowd, but I still might be hanging on.
You might be John Millhiser. I can't actually tell the difference sometimes.
I do kind of fit into the Millhiser Mooney, like, you know, scrawny, kind of awkward looking white men. So, you know what? If I'm on there next year, don't be surprised.
Yeah. All right. Good. I like it.
All right. So we are here to recap the, I'm going to use the term mid-season finale, even though this isn't like Walking Dead or Once Upon a Time or anything. I'll use the term mid-season finale of SNL hosted by Amy Adams. Rich, were you excited to hear? I think the news was released about a month ago that Amy Adams would be hosting the Christmas show. What were your initial reactions to that?
It was mixed in that I like Amy Adams a lot. I have been a fan of hers since she was Jim's girlfriend on The Office back in 1907.
The first girl.
Yes, exactly. I've liked her on many things. I liked her her first hosting duties in 2008. But in the Christmas episode, as I think we discussed when it was announced, I was very upset that we did not have an alumni host, because I enjoy the alumni hosting the Christmas episodes. Now, Santa did kind of come and give me my wish a little bit sooner than I expected. So I was going in kind of mixed on this one. But I like her, and I think ultimately that's what matters.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm not a giant Amy Adams fan. I find her to be fine, but it is kind of staggering to think about that she's a 5-time Academy Award nominee. In particular, I saw her in American Hustle last year, and I wasn't particularly impressed. I will say one thing, not to dive too much into this episode, because we'll go through it chronologically, but she is very much in the same vein as Cameron Diaz was to me, in that there weren't any like standout moments from her this episode, but she fit very well into the rest of the ensemble of the show.
Yeah, I specifically like, as an overall note, the thing that I liked about her, and I was surprised that we saw this with Cameron Diaz, that the thing about Amy Adams is she plays a great straight person. So instead of her needing to be the weird one, for the most part, couple of fun exceptions to this, she got to play the straight person with a weird person in a sketch. And I think, especially with a big cast like this, that's kind of what we need. We don't really need another person to be wacky. So I was happy about that.
Yeah, I'd say it actually pairs really nicely with Martin Freeman, who I know you guys talked about last week, and it's been talked about generally on the internet about how, I mean, that's his career is based off of straight men. And Amy Adams, it doesn't necessarily fall into that, but these hosts do work really well playing the straight man, specifically against some of these really, really crazy characters. But let's not bury the lead here. Let's jump in, shall we?
Sure. So, you know, interesting bait and switch. I always like a good bait and switch. We start with a very somber Christmas with Sam Smith. And of course, we're going to spend 90% of this section talking about Dr. Evil. But before we do, I got to say, I don't feel like Taron Killam's Sam Smith gets enough credit. I really like this impression. I feel like it feels kind of accurate, but it also feels fun. We saw him do this in Young Tarts and Old Farts on the Woody Harrelson episode, and he actually sings pretty well, and he brings sort of a fun energy to it. So even before we get to Dr. Evil, I really enjoyed kind of going into this. Also, I was going to say another weird oddity, and this is getting super nerdy on SNL, but hey, we're here, so let's go there. Very odd that the opening was Beck Bennett doing the VO of the very somber Sam Smith Christmas, because this was classic Don Pardo. This would always be Don Pardo doing this kind of an opening. So odd that we didn't have Daryl Hammond kind of getting us into this, which I thought was just an interesting note about sort of what's going on with Daryl Hammond and in filling that role. So all of this by lead up of saying, you know, the big reveal is it's the I don't even say the return. I don't know that we've ever seen him on SNL. You know, it was Dr. Evil showing up in the cold open, which was a big surprise.
Mm-hmm. I'll say a couple of quick points of what you just talked about. First, yeah. I mean, you've talked about it in the past. The cast and crew are clearly listening to you guys on this podcast. Maybe they heard you guys complaining about Daryl Hammond doing the credits so much that they put him in the doghouse a bit. Now he doesn't have announcing duties with any other sketches.
Maybe he's being downsized and we don't even know it.
Exactly. I completely agree with you about Taron Killam's Sam Smith impression. And I would say two of the most undervalued talents among the SNL staff right now is probably Taron Killam's singing ability and Bobby Moynihan's dance ability. They've been mm-hmm. known to like do both in the past. I don't know. Taron, I think he went to LOXA, the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts or whatever it's called. But he has a fantastic singing voice. And Bobby Moynihan is as he showed in the Kim Jong-un cold open from earlier in the season, is a great dancer. And we see that with the French sketches going back the past couple of years. So it's interesting. But I guess moving on to Dr. Evil here, it's man, what a pull. I'm trying to figure out, like, let's posit this, Rich. How do we think this happened? Do we think that Mike Myers reached out to SNL and said this would be a fun opportunity for Dr. Evil to come in? Or do you think the writers were just spitballing things on a Monday night and said, like, you know what? It'd be funny if Dr. Evil came. Let's get Mike Myers on the phone.
Mike, that's a very nerdy question, of which I have spent a lot of time thinking about. Exactly. I'm in exactly your nerd headspace as well. I thought about this a lot. And interestingly, he's got Mike Myers has nothing to promote. Nothing is coming up, and he has no connection to Amy Adams there. So there's really no reason for him to show up for something like this. So my take on it was that I think that this all came from him. I don't think that they have a relationship with Mike Myers where anyone calls him to say, wouldn't it be funny if? I think that Mike Myers saw this whole thing going down with Sony and North Korea and thought, you know what, this is crazy. I would like to do something. And I think that he made a call to Lorne and said, I'd like to come on as Dr. Evil and open the show and do kind of a riff that probably he wrote, maybe with some of his friends. I would suspect that he wrote this and come down and do it. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, because we also really haven't seen him. I mean, Mike Myers hasn't hosted it in at least, I'd say, about 15 years. And the two times we've seen him in the past 10 years or so were kind of cameos. One, he appeared in with Dana Carvey when Dana Carvey hosted. They did a Wayne's World, I remember, about the Academy Awards. The other one was when Kanye West was the musical guest, and this was right after the George Bush doesn't care about black people controversy. He appeared and they had like a little awkward moment. But besides that, I feel like Mike Myers is one of those alumni that like is might not be the most buddy-buddy with Lorne and the SNL studios to be getting brought back all the time. That being said, what did you think about, I mean, you know, it was a wild surprise to see Dr. Evil. Obviously, nobody saw it coming. But looking back in it, I know you rewatch it. What did you think about the Dr. Evil stuff on the whole?
I mean, I really liked it. And I will say that with the caveat that is very obvious, which is we had a couple of really classic clunker jokes in there that really kind of just bombed. But overall, I mean, it was just such a fun, not only the get of Mike Myers, but the perfect fit of Dr. Evil with the whole North Korea thing. The writing, I thought, was generally speaking solid. A couple of really fun lines, couple of clunkers, a couple of middle down the roads. But also to see Mike Myers do this, I mean, as much as I feel like I've kind of should have fallen out of the Mike Myers camp because I've heard second and third and fourth and fifth hand so many stories about how difficult he is and how he's kind of not a good guy. I don't know that they're true. true, but I sort of take them to believe that they probably are true. So I've been kind of, I sort of fell out of love with Mike Myers, but to see him do this was like, oh, right, he's really good at this. And it really did flash me not to the Austin Powers movies as much as to, you know, the seasons of him, you know, doing the Dieter and doing, you know, all of his great characters, Linda Richman on SNL and going, boy, this guy, he really still has it. So even though I don't think all of the jokes landed, some of them were classic groaners. They were so bad. Overall, I really liked it. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. I think for me, it was a little bit of shaking off the rust just because I kind of forgot the tone of Dr. Evil. And I think it's a little odd just because in the Austin Powers movies, it's a little bit of a timeless character. You know, he's obviously from the 60s, froze himself. Spoiler alert, by the way, for the Austin Powers
right.
films. You know, it's 60s characters living in the 90s is the basic game concept of the Austin Powers in the first film, at least. So, like, it's a very timeless character. Parts of it felt a little anachronistic to me. Like putting him in the whole Sony situation was a little interesting. That being said, I did like a lot of this stuff. And I mean, like you said, Mike Myers is a fantastic character person. He has that character down to a T, and it wasn't long before I got back into the rhythms of Dr. Evil.
Yeah. And interesting to your point, I think the only point that I really got pulled out of it was not the few lines that kind of missed. For me, what really pulled me out of it was the callback to $1 million.
Yeah.
And it kind of just felt like, ooh, we're going there. That just sort of felt like it. And I liked that we sort of did that little tag of been there, done that, smoked it, humped it, called it an Uber.
Yeah.
I do feel like this is the season where Uber is the joke, is the punchline that is inserted when people want to feel current.
Yeah, I'm surprised they moved on from Ebola.
Yeah, exactly. It did replace the. It definitely replaced the Ebola. That definitely. So, but yeah, in general, I really enjoyed this. I mean, you know, the GOP joke with Guardians of Peace, I thought was really fun. You know, I thought it was very interesting that he buttoned the whole piece with him making a joke about how bad the Love Guru was. You know, I know from I don't know if you heard him interviewed on the Marc Maron podcast. What the fuck? But he actually called out the fact Marc Maron called out the fact that he was not allowed to bring up the Love Guru in that interview, which was, by the way, a very good interview. So interesting that he made the very calculated choice to end on a dig at himself. So interesting setup. That said, here's my question for you, Mike, as an SNL fan, during it, while it was going on, I'm enjoying it. I'm in the moment, but there's one nagging concern or annoy. Like I'm pre-annoyed by something that I know is going to happen. Was there anything that you felt as you're watching it or thinking to yourself, something is going to happen later on in the show that is going to annoy the hell out of me?
Oh God, I'm trying to think now of like Mike Myers.
It's very annoying. It's very nerdy, too. I'm wondering. I'll be interested to see in the comments, since we're not live today, if anyone had the same feeling. This was me. And again, this is so ultra nerdy. I'm thinking, I'm loving this. I'm loving that Mike Myers is back. I'm loving he's making fun of myself, fun of himself. And you know what? This mother effer is not going to show up on stage for the good nights. This prima donna is not going to show up for the good nights. And I felt icky even thinking it. And I was right. The hump couldn't show up to say good night. He couldn't stand on a stage for 2 minutes and 30 seconds and make small talk with the rest of the cast. And I thought that's what says everything about Mike Myers, not the Dr. Evil sketch, not the cold open, but the fact that he couldn't show up and just congenially chat with the cast for 2.5 minutes really said a lot about Mike Myers to me.
Mm-hmm. When we got to the goodbyes, I was actually going to ask about that, but that totally makes sense now. I could totally see Mike Myers, even after this sketch, getting out of costume makeup and just leaving.
Yep, I absolutely think that was the idea. He probably hung with Lauren for a little bit and maybe Jim Downey or someone and then probably just got out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So after our always lukewarm credit sequence, we hop right into the monologue. And Rich, I know you came from New York this past weekend. How many
yes.
Times Square Elmos did you run into on your trip?
About five or six, but I had scheduled three of the visits. So okay. It's probably not a fair. Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, and this was, you're right about, boy, such great energy coming out of that cold open to then be lulled by the Daryl Hammond somber snooze thing. And then coming into this monologue, and I got to say, like, I liked it. I think I'm the only person in the United States who liked the monologue. I didn't love it, but I really liked it. I really thought this was, you've heard me say this a lot, this is one of those pieces that I thought was fun, even though it wasn't funny. And I really just had a lot of fun watching this.
I will say the thing I did enjoy about it was that it was structured. I mean, we look at some other sketches, I think the Sarah Silverman one is a good example of like how disjointed it felt, that it was like partly a stand-up set and it was partly questions from the audience, that it just didn't feel like one piece of monologue. And this definitely felt like one. It was also pretty long too. I have to say though, and this is probably going to draw a lot of ire from the internet, especially people my age, I gotta say it, Rich, I am not a big fan of Kristen Wiig on SNL.
This podcast is over. Unplug the mics.
Good night.
Remove yourself. How that you saying that is akin to Sinead O'Connor ripping up a photo of the Pope during a musical
performance. Fight the real
enemy. I mean, yeah, I love Kristen Wiig. Now, I will say that with the caveat that I think I can imagine, you know, Kristen Wiig did many great characters well beyond their welcome was worn out to the point of just really a groan. So I could imagine, I can understand that, even though it's crazy to me, but I could see you saying that. But boy, she is, to me, I just found her, I love her and her energy. I thought, I don't think, for me, I look at the entire female cast right now, and I really think that the only female character that has that, the charisma, not the talent, but the charisma of Kristen Wiig, would only be Kate McKinnon. I don't think anybody else in the current cast has that kind of charisma.
And you hit the nail on the head, which is one my main critique. And I'll preface, you know, or I guess I'll do a footnote to my comment by saying that I am not a big fan of her on SNL. I think she is an absolutely fantastic performer. I've loved almost all of her filmography that she's done so thus far. Bridesmaids, Friends with Kids, the most likely or Girl Most Likely was not a great movie, but she did a great job in it. So, I mean, she's a fantastic performer. And like you said, I mean, I love a lot of her one-time stuff. I really, her like early stuff, her like Megan Mullally impressions, and when she played Judy Garland in the Vincent Price specials, I really enjoyed that. The turning point for me was when, like you said, it was when Lauren realized, like, oh, these people like these characters. Let's, and I hate to use this term, but like beat them into the ground almost. And this is when we got a lot of what you would call Mad Libs writing, where it was just, let's put Penelope in another place and have the exact same things happen. We'll get to your favorites, Garth and Kat, later, but it was a very similar thing. Denise, I think we saw Denise about five more times than we needed to. So I think
how many secret word sketches did we see during Wiig's tenure, which was the same game show sketch over and over again? I totally agree.
So yeah. I think that's my annoyance with her tenure on SNL, was just that I think it led to lazy writing. And one of the things that I'll say, this era, the post Sandberg hater Wiig era, has going for it, is that it's throwing out all these original characters and original sketches, and that it's able to really just throw things at the wall and see what sticks. And it's able to get a lot more creative stuff out there than saying, okay, let's have the Don't Make Me Sing person come back again and do something.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And I thought, so I would say on this, I mean, again, it was it was fun. I thought the energy was good. I think Kristen Wiig's great with the side. She's so comfortable on that stage. I would say that the piece kept moving, and it was, even though it was not particularly brilliant, it also wasn't totally predictable. I liked that I didn't go, oh, I know where this is going next. Even the fact that like they sort of twisted it to where the two women were going to kiss for a moment. It was just it's like, where did that come from? So yeah. big production number at the end, which was not even trying to be funny. It was just fun. But I thought I liked it. I also will say I liked it a little bit more than I should have, because compared to last season, by the time we got to the third episode in December, we had beat the hell out of Christmas. We had already had like 20 Christmas sketches before the finale, where we didn't have that last year. So I just enjoyed the whole Christmasness of it all.
That makes sense. So let's also compare this, because as mentioned in the monologue, Kristen Wiig did crash Amy Adams' monologue when she hosted back in 2008. This is when she was just a featured player, but she got a lot of spotlight because she happened to look like Amy Adams back when Kristen Wiig had longer, more reddish brownish hair, and they sang a song from Wicked, and so I'm also, again, you know, my brain's always turning with the production values behind this. Do you think that Amy Adams wanted to sing and said, let me bring in Kristen again, or do you think they're like, okay, Kristen Wiig says she wants to come back for this episode, let's put her in the monologue and let's have them sing something?
I'm going to go with 2B, which is, I think that they reached out to Kristen Wiig because I think that they needed a cameo of an alumni in the monologue, because probably as this was being arranged, there was no concept of Mike Myers showing up. So I think that this was brokered at a time when it was going to be a classic cold open, and they felt like, you know what, people are used to Jimmy Fallon showing up for the Christmas episode. Let's get Kristen to come back. We'll have her and Fred Armisen in a couple of sketches. That will be our alumni piece. So I think that they brokered that, not knowing that Mike Myers was going to come and do Dr. Evil.
Mm-hmm. Which Kristen Wiig appearance do you like more this season in terms of a monologue, this or the Bill Hader monologue?
I think this. I mean, I think that the Bill Hader monologue was very fun, but it did feel very predictable, and it felt like nothing more than two old friends just kind of being silly together, and more sort of to make each other laugh than anything else. And I liked it, but I thought this to me was just I wouldn't say it was funny, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun.
I can definitely understand that. But let's move on from our monologue into our first sketch. Pre-tape, Rich, it's Asian American Doll.
Yeah, this was interesting. I wanted to like this more because this was such a great idea. And I think I was thinking I quickly fell out of enjoying this sketch as an audience member and kind of put on my amateur sketch writer hat as I was watching this, and this thinking, as really smart as this is a hard idea to execute and do it well, because it was sort of like we're trying to be funny by not saying things as opposed to what we can say. So I thought this was a really solid attempt. I'm really glad they did it, but I would say I found it to be very clever, but not always that funny.
Mm-hmm. I would say the equivalent of this type of sketch, it was a sketch that occurred during the Woody Harrelson episode called The Dudleys, which was the sitcom family where people kept writing in and complaining, so they kept changing it. I think SNL is trying to make an attempt at kind of the mood around this year. Now, if I had to kind of characterize a term around 2014, it's been mentioned in articles before, I would say 2014 is the year that we got offended. It seemed like there were a lot of scandals happening, and there was a lot of mentions about, you know, race relations, gender relations, sexuality relations, all those different types of things. And I think this is another attempt of like SNL dealing with the whole facet that happened this year of like a lot of complaints rolling in about, you know, being politically correct or being racially correct. That being said, I'm probably a little higher on it than you are. There are two things that really sold it for me. One was the child actors. I thought the child actors did a really great job on some of those lines and some of those questions of like, you know, like, oh, what country is she from? And I loved, unfortunately, this was the only appearance we got of Vanessa Bayer this evening, which is very sad.
A shame. Yeah.
Because she killed it in that mom role, too.
This is her character. I mean, this really is the, you know, this is the same character we saw in the Vitamix sketch at the end of the Sarah Silverman, kind of the, you know, the, or, and in some ways, the, you know, the woman in the egg, I can't remember what it was, the Nespresso.
Nespresso, yeah.
Yeah, but she does this so well, and she walks the line between I'm in on it, I'm not in this as the character, and did it really, really well. I thought she did a really good job in this sketch.
Yeah, I loved the one moment when you know, Cecily, the narrator, says that she couldn't really give her anything to say, and I love the visual of like them pulling out the string to say something that just comes right off, and Vanessa says, "Oh no, but you could have done something." She tries to do several gestures, but slowly realizes that she's coming off as racist. That being said, I thought Cecily's narrator was fun as well, because it was she was trying to combine that typical childhood doll commercial narrator with, like, you know, the typical Cecily thing of like, "All right, you ask a lot of questions. You should go outside now. Bye."
Yeah, she does a really good job of selling, you know, Asian American doll. We made it from a place of fear. Like, she's got a really good, like, selling the lines that are sort of, you know, jokes on that stuff. So, yeah, I thought she did a nice job, too. And I agree with you that I think they're really sort of going after political correctness in a very clever way, as opposed to a very obvious way this season. And even the stuff that I think doesn't always land 100%, I still am glad that they're doing it. I think that it works really well.
Exactly. And the gong takes us into our first live sketch of the evening after the monologue. It's Tenderfield Christmas, the YouTube video. We have another YouTube video sketch.
Yeah, this is our second lampoon since How to Dance with Janelle from the Chris Rock. So this is sort of two interesting things to comment about. I didn't love this sketch. I thought it was interesting. I don't know that I had ever seen the original sketch that this was making fun of, but I went back and saw it afterwards. I don't remember it. It was definitely funnier if I had just seen a video. So it's odd that we're making fun of a video that came out 2 years ago, not even last year. So that was a little bit weird, or maybe it was last year, but it was so long ago that I don't know who actually remembered this sketch. I don't know that I loved this. I thought this was fine. I don't think it ended very well. I want to hear your thoughts, and then I just want to step back and talk about sort of this Saturday Night Live YouTube thing. But what did you think of the sketch?
So I actually did not know about this either, and I actually didn't know it was based on a video. I thought it was another, like you said, for another YouTube sketch from like the Chris Rock episode or like a Jared's Room. It was just a general YouTube video. I didn't know it was actually based on something. That being said, it had the tone of, I don't know the names of those sketches, but remember those sketches when like four guys would sit around in a bar and they would sing along to the chorus of a song and each tell really weird stories? It had very much the tone of that in terms of each family member had a story. There was only one story that I really liked, and it was the story about the Kyle Mooney son who wanted a dog, so they got him a dog, and the dog bit him and dragged him out into the woods, and now he thinks he's a dog. Like, I thought that was probably the funniest part, and it was kind of weird that it didn't really heighten from there. It just kind of went back to Kate McKinnon's Susie is a sociopath. I thought it had a lot of fun energy to it. Maybe it's because it was to the song Will Smith's Miami. But I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I liked the Susie is a sociopath thing the most, I think. And again, I just think that's, and you know, Rob and I don't always agree on this. I think that Kate McKinnon is the closer. I think that she can come in and just nail it. And I think that it was a mistake to then try to close it with Keenan, who kind of did nothing. And again, I'm saying this like I can write these sketches easier than anyone else. I understand how hard it is, but I think that Kate McKinnon brings such a big energy that if you're going to have her do something like that, you close on it because she's so fun.
I completely agree.
Yeah. But I would say, you know, this is what's hard. I like that SNL is trying to get away from, oh, we're doing parodies of weekend morning news shows, which nobody watches. And instead, we're making fun of things like YouTube videos. And I said this with sort of How to Dance with Janelle. This is YouTube videos don't translate to being made fun of on live television because, you know, the language of YouTube videos is jump cuts. It's intentional, rhythmic jump cutting, not only because the people who started doing it needed to because they weren't editors and they didn't have two cameras, but it's become sort of the language of YouTube. And so these videos where in this video, we're even cutting between two cameras, but not having those jump cuts just makes it, it immediately removes this and anything, even How to Dance with Janelle, as feeling like a YouTube video. So I really think, as much as I'm glad they're trying to do YouTube, I would really encourage the writing staff to think about if they want to make fun of YouTube videos, I think it's got to be pre-taped, and they've got to do it in the style of vloggers so that we really feel like we're making fun of vloggers and making fun of the YouTube videos that the audience is seeing. Because this 60 frame a second video, no jump cut, pristine quality, it, you know, it just doesn't feel like what we know as YouTube. And so it feels very false to me. And I think they're really hurting themselves for that.
I know I'm a good neighbor apologist in terms of responding to you guys on the podcast, but I actually think the good neighbor people would probably kill, absolutely slay some sort of YouTube video sketch like that. I mean, that if it was somewhat in the vein of like those weird like campaign videos that they've done, I think they do a great job with editing. And I agree. I mean, I think the How to Dance with Janelle thing had the quote unquote excuse that they were live streaming, so they didn't need to do any sort of cuts away. But I think I agree. I think it benefits from it. And I think a lot of comedy and viral videos in general comes from editing and jump cuts and everything like that. And you can still keep those elements in whilst keeping it pre-taped. So I would agree with that. It's nice to see an update to something like Jared's Room, but I think they're able to capitalize more on the medium itself to bring the comedy out of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I definitely agree. So hopefully we'll see more down the road, where they better attempts at this. And while I think you and I probably disagree about the Good Neighbor sketches, I do agree that they are very good at recreating not only a look, but a tone of other media. So that would be interesting to see Dave McCary, the director of that group, sort of put his eye towards a classic YouTube sketch from maybe one of the other writers, Katie Rich or somebody, to see what they could do.
All right, so let's get to probably the biggest viral takeaway of this week's show, and probably I would say maybe the past few weeks. This is the Serial parody. Now, Rich, to preface this, were you a Serial listener? Are you a Serial listener?
Yes. Yes, okay, I was. Yes. Well. Yes, I was. I've been a multi-decade This American Life listener. So the Serial was a no-brainer. Although, like many people, I came to it late, binged to catch up, and then finished out the season. So I remember early on, I think it was Alex Wolpen who on Twitter had called out to us like, "Where's the Serial parody?" And I felt like I just don't know if it's just too niche, and I think it just built and built and built in popularity. So I was very excited. The timing was perfect on this one. This was, as, and I'm not the first to say this, this was an absolute split decision from America on this one. Everyone who listened to Serial, like myself, I think loved this video, and everyone who had not heard Serial was just completely bored through the entire thing. And I actually liked that. I actually mm-hmm. give that credit. But while I'm going to say some negative things about it, I thought they did an excellent job, and I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think I'll take a quote from Rob that he said on Twitter, in absentia. I really, really enjoyed this sketch too, and I'm a Serial listener as well. The one huge thing I could take away from this is, oh my god, everyone in this sketch had the cadences down
to a T
of every single person they were impersonating, whether it was it was Cecily as Sarah Koenig, or it was Kyle Mooney as the Adnan-like character, or whether it was Aidy Bryan as the Christina Gutierrez-like character. It's absolutely amazing. But I will take the quote from Rob that I think, like you said about the monologue, I think this was fun, but not haha funny. I think rewatching it especially, I don't think there were any laugh lines that I took down, but just like observing it is like, was just, it's fantastic. It's a Serial nerd's dream to just watch this happen.
Yeah, and this, and I think the reason was, I'm going to, again, put on my true comedy nerd hat here. This was a classic case of all we really did, and again, I'm not saying I could walk in and write something better, but just to as an observer, it was really just a classic mapping game. It was like, let's take what if the gang from Serial investigated Santa Claus, but I think the reason there were no big laughs here is because it didn't try to say anything about Serial. It really just mapped Serial to Santa Claus. So there was no point of view about Serial that was expressed in the writing of the sketch. And I think that generally when we can feel the writer's point of view about the thing that they are making fun of is when we get the big laughs. And this was really just, wouldn't it be funny if? So that mapping game I feel like gave us a really nice solid through line and a lot of nice moments to do all the different pieces of, as you said, Adie Bryant was fantastic and Kris Kringle and even Jay Farrow as Jay the Elf was really funny and all these cute little nuances to the audio podcast, but didn't necessarily give us a big laugh because it never really made fun of Serial or called it out as something, the things about it that should have been made fun of. But that said, I thought it was still really fun to watch.
Yeah, and I gotta say, they had a big hurdle to climb considering that Serial has hit the mainstream for being an audio podcast, and they basically had to put visuals to an extremely audio media, popular item. And the fact that they were able to use a lot of the cinematography of like the vintage shots and a lot of the cutaways and everything, I think it worked well. I don't think it took away from anything that was going on. If I did have one qualm, I would say, and I think we talked about this a little bit on Twitter before we recorded, the MailChimp joke at the end for me was a little didn't need to be there.
Well, and it definitely felt like the one piece that was oddly inaccurate in order to just get it in under budget or under time, because for a piece that was amazingly accurate to the show in all of its nuances, to have Dana, the producer, talk about MailChimp was so off brand for what they actually had done on the real show. So that, I feel like they just tacked that on at the last second as a just in case, and then they didn't have anything better, or they had shot something longer and it was cut for time. I don't know, but I definitely agree with you. But overall, really fun. And I got to say, I have to imagine, I can't remember another time, the first time that a podcast has been lampooned on SNL, which is very, very cool. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, it really has broken through. Who knows? Before you know it, they'll do a post-show recaps parody.
Yeah, I thought it was that would be fun. I think could Bobby Moynihan play me? That would be so great.
Yes, absolutely.
And not to spend too much time on it because I know we're going long, but did you see the Funny or Die take on Serial? I know we were all talking about this on Twitter with SNL alumni Michaela Watkins as Sarah Koenig.
Yeah, so I was actually going to ask you about that as well. Yeah. I did see it and I enjoyed it, and I thought it was, I think both sketches actually had a very simple game. I think the Funny or Die one was a lot more focused. It was only the impersonations of Sarah Koenig and Adnan. They didn't really, you know, broaden it out to anything, and they kept it to pretty much inside a studio. But I thought it was a really fun sketch, and I liked not to spoil the ending for anyone, but I really enjoyed the ending for it as well. So it's interesting. I'm not sure which one I would pick right now if I had to pick between the two of which one I liked more, just because, I mean, the sheer feat that the SNL version went through and was able to accomplish, with the exception of that one MailChimp joke, is astounding.
Yeah, I thought I liked the Funny or Die one before. I had seen it originally and I liked it. And I like Michaela Watkins a lot, but I thought I liked this one so much better because I felt like it just hit on so many different points and was so much more. I'm trying to say something without giving away. If you didn't see the Funny or Die sketch, I didn't love the Funny or Die ending as much as maybe you did. Mm-hmm. So I felt it was sort of building up to something. And I was like, how are they going to end this? Where this one was just sort of solid throughout. So, but both really great. I really like them both.
Well, Rich, it's time for the return of Girlfriends Talk Show for, I think, the first time this season. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I think the first time since Charlize Theron from the end of last year. We're on such a roll. Oh, boy.
Now, yeah. I have to give this sketch one piece of credit. We were just talking about with Kristen Wiig during the monologue that there is such thing as Mad Libs writing. And I feel like for the past few iterations of Girlfriends Talk Show, there is a lot of iterations of Mad Libs writing where, like, someone comes in and becomes friends with Cecily's character, and then Amy's character says something weird. They at least made a different attempt at this. It wasn't so much that Amy Adams' character was trying to become best friends with Cecily's character. It was just that it was actually, I would say, the sketch in general was more turned towards Amy Bryant's character, which had its benefits and its drawbacks.
Yeah, I guess I'll sort of disagree a little bit with you. I mean, you're not wrong, but for me, it just felt like we've seen this before, which is the guest that is a surprise to A.D. Bryant's character is ultimately going to embarrass A.D. Bryant, or A.D. Bryant's character is going to embarrass herself in some way. It's just such a form. I mean, this felt like a formula, like baby formula sitting on Rob's counter for 2 years without being refrigerated. I was like, it's such a stale formula, even to the point where as soon as Cecily Strong starts saying, talking about my boyfriend, that I'm just like, oh, it's just like, I'm just waiting for her to go, my boyfriend's crazy. And it's just exactly just blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we knew One Direction was going to make a cameo. This was the perfect point. I didn't think they were funny in any way. It was just, you know, young guys being hammy. And, you know, I did like when one of them asked if they could dance with Morgan, and she said, I'm blasting out of my pants right now. I thought that was very funny.
It's interesting, though. The One Direction guys also, it's interesting, they all attempted American accents except for Harry Styles, who wore his little douchey hat throughout the entire evening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I really have nothing else to say about this other than, oh boy.
Yeah. It's this sketch might have to eat a bitch sandwich soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's move into something that we also haven't seen in a while. It's a Jay Farrow helmed pre-tape sketch song type of thing. We saw this a bunch last year, but I think this is, again, the first time we're seeing it this year. It is Office Christmas Party.
Yeah, this I thought was actually pretty fun, despite having a point. And maybe I missed it in the two times that I watched it, but I never really kind of got what the point of this sketch was. But that said, I had a lot of fun along the way watching it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really fun here and there. There was a couple of really fun specifics, but I didn't quite know, like, it's the boring Christmas party. My Christmas wish is to have these, you know, these two guys show up to make it a great Christmas party. But then it didn't really go much further other than showing what are kind of classic tropes of a Christmas party of people drinking too much. So and there wasn't even a lot of interaction between Jay Farrow or Pete Davidson with the people at the Christmas party. So fun, but I'd say kind of it was just okay for me.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you, and we'll kind of frame this around a question from the great Jeremiah Panhorst. He asked us, what would you guys do to make the Office Party song better? And you totally hit the nail on the head in terms of the specifics in the first, like, half of the song were great. I love, you know, Dave did an impression of the IT guy and crushed it. Kevin's still trying to finish up some work. Brandon made a slideshow but can't work the projector. When that happened, it was great. But then I think once it got to A.D. Bryant's character, like, getting drunk and tackling the Christmas tree, I think it went a little off the rails. I know it's really tough to heighten in those circumstances, but if they were able to really keep it in those office specifics, I think it would have made the song a lot funnier.
Yeah, because I think if the point of it was about sort of the awkward Christmas party, as opposed to now we're sort of blowing it out. I agree with you. I liked A.D. Bryant tackling the Christmas tree and getting a little crazy, but I was sort of like, but what's the point? And I really like Bobby as the voice making it rain gift cards, but it was sort of like, but that does kind of sort of happen at Christmas parties. So what is Pete and Jay doing to make this different? So I thought it definitely was I think that it was a great idea, but I think somewhere along the way in writing it they lost the focus, which was a shame.
Interestingly enough, I believe the so far the serial pre-tape is the only sketch so far where Amy Adams has not either sung or danced or both.
Yes, I think that you're right. I think that you're right. The other thing that I would comment on, I didn't think of this. I will give credit to reading Splitsider. They always do such a great job in their recaps, pointing out one of the things that we do see a little bit lacking in pieces like this year and last year as well, is that the Lonely Island guys, even though a lot of their pieces started to get very trite and very predictable, they were very good at writing catchy hooks for their parody songs. Mm-hmm. And this definitely lacked from this. And I think we saw the same thing with the girls coming home for Thanksgiving earlier in the season, that another song that was a lot of fun, but the song itself wasn't particularly catchy. I don't think we've had a great catchy song since Do It On My Twin Bed, which is going back, you know, literally a year ago at this point. And I can't write music, so I don't know how one does it better, but I will give the Lonely Island guys credit that they did a great job at least at creating hooks that were very memorable.
And I can't think of a better segue into our musical guest One Direction now. Unfortunately, due to the holidays, we do not have the musical correspondent James Keast with us, but I know Rich Tackenberg over here is probably the number one fan of One Direction, so I'm sure he would love to helm the conversation on these five young gentlemen as musical guests in this episode.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge One Direction fan, as everyone knows. I've been a fan of theirs since they got together in 1972. I'm a fan of Harry and Channing and Kyle and Mooney and the blonde guy with the guitar.
Niles. Yeah. Niles. He was the bassist on the character from Frasier.
Exactly. So this was their new song called I'm So Lonely and Good Looking. It's off their new album, which is A New Direction, I believe. And like the girls, I just swooned over it. I thought that, you know, the guys do a really fantastic job of standing and singing on cue. They might be animatronic robots from Disneyland's Hall of Presidents with longer hair, but they hit the beats as they are expected to. Their shirts are perfectly unbuttoned to the appropriate length, and that's what I look for in a good musical performance.
I couldn't tell if Harry Styles looked more like a Johnny Depp character or a Diane Keaton character.
That's a good point. A good mix of the two. A good mix of the two. Yeah.
So if Johnny Depp did Annie Hall, that's what Harry Styles was dressed like.
Exactly. So so this song, sure, why not? One Direction, thumbs up. Why not?
And their second song, I believe they did Born to Run, that Bruce Springsteen cover, right?
Yeah, one thing I will say that definitely made me laugh when they came back to sing is, it's all about I'm Ready to Run, which was very ironic for five guys who just stand at the mic for every single song. I was like, oh my God, I like, we're really mixing it up. We're going to put the blonde guy with the guitar in the center. So that's really mixing it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the other commands that they're programmed to do is to like reach out and high five fans in the audience, but that's clearly not going to happen in Studio 8H. So
yeah,
I think they were set with the prime directive, which is to stand there, contort your face, and just emote.
Yes, this reminded me not so much of other musical guests, but it reminded me of being at VidCon last year, the YouTube convention, which I attended with the company I was at, and just the mass of screaming girls and that certain decibel that gets hit and that certain frequency that only young girls could hit. And I just, and listening to that, I thought, oh, I feel so bad for the people, the cast members that are trying to do at times very subtle comedy when your audience is just loaded with screaming girls trying to see One Direction.
Yeah, I would say I think there were some diminishing returns, because I do remember for the Paul Rudd episode when they were on last year, that I think it was a lot more prevalent that the audience was full of One Direction fans. But this Amy Adams episode got a lot of laughs. It wasn't like the Justin Bieber episode where it was clear the fangirls had overwhelmed the audience at that point, and there was not going to be any laughs happening.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's segue here into weekend update. Now, before we jump into talking about our guests and probably some jokes here and there, I have a question from Sue Hawkeye that we can kind of frame it around. halfway through the season, what are your thoughts on Che and Jost as an update team? We've seen 10 episodes of them as at this point as a team. Che's first 10 episodes, Colin had a little bit of a head start on him. Rich, what do you think about them as a team in general?
I'm going to grade them at this point a solid B. I'm happy to say that we're at the point where I can give them a B, but I don't think better than that. I think that they're getting a lot of praise right now, and I'm glad that they're getting the praise, but I think it's because they started out in such a hole that we're finally working up to it. I'm a broken record on this. I like Michael Che a lot, but I don't think that his energy is necessarily right for the show, for Weekend Update. I did like his little rant about Kim Jong-un and look, Kimberly, that little rant I thought was very cute. That was sort of more in his tone. The thing where I'd like to see Michael Che move is his tone works really well when the material is really inappropriate, because he can kind of get away with it in a way that that other people can't. So like there was a little bit of a run, and I won't do the jokes because I won't do them justice, but where Michael Che did a whole thing about Kathy Lee Gifford and Bill Cosby and talking about how she, you know, amazing that she rejected a glass of wine. And I felt like it occurred to me, no, that's a Michael Che joke. That's what he should be doing. And he does those so well, and it was nice to realize that he's sort of finding a tone to which I would even think that. So I think Colin Jost is definitely fine. He's a good guy. He certainly knows how to just sell a joke, you know, set up punchline joke. I don't necessarily see the connection between them yet. Certainly there was a great missed opportunity that I think every other pairing would have touched on, which is Jost had a great joke about some golfer doing a Bubba Christmas. And he said, that's going to be on, that's what I call music, or, you know, that's what Michael Che likes as music, or whatever the punchline was. And they throw it to Michael Che, and he kind of giggles and then goes right into the next joke. And I thought, that's the problem with these two guys. That's the moment that Jost is supposed to make a comment to acknowledge the camaraderie between them, or the playfulness between them, that I think that we're just still missing 10 episodes in.
Mm-hmm. So I'll make a few points of that. First, I think you mixed up Jost and Che in your last episode.
Oh, sorry.
I think Jost actually was the one that made the Kathy Lee Gifford joke, I believe.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying you're right. I was saying I wish that was Michael
Che. Oh, you wish it was Che.
I'm sorry. I feel like that should have been Michael Che. I probably was unclear. It occurred to me that Michael Che is starting to get a vibe and a tone, and it was mistakenly given to Colin Jost, in my opinion. It should have been Michael Che.
Yeah. So I will say that I think they're two very funny men individually, but I think they, as you said, there's a huge dimorphism going on with these two different tomes. It almost feels like it's Seth Meyers partners up with Norm MacDonald almost. I think Che kind of has that Norm MacDonald like devil may care attitude, and as you said, with some of the jokes he's been making, with the the Dick Cheney joke he made last week, and even his Kimberly rant,
right.
it was pretty scathing, and I think that is a little tough to combat with Jost, who is like almost literally a Seth Meyers clone. And so I completely agree. I think there was a little bit of chemistry in the beginning, but it seems like they've shied away from that. So I think there is a discrepancy there. I would say that Che started out stronger for me at the beginning of the season, but now I think Jost has kind of built up a momentum, and I think he's landed some pretty solid jokes. I think the one thing that this partnership may be missing, at least with Jost, is a wild card, and that's kind of the role that Cecily filled. And it was the Jimmy Fallon role, it was the Amy Poehler role. It was the way it works the best is if you have kind of more of a straight faced, more serious person, and you have kind of the goofball who plays up the characters. That's why I actually enjoyed the Collins Cecily pairing, as short lived as it may have been. So I mean, I'm assuming they're going to keep going with these guys, but and we'll see from the correspondence coming in. I think it's tough to see them both play straight man. And Michael Che in particular does not make a fantastic straight man.
I completely agree with you. I definitely don't feel that he has worked. He has made a correspondent better for his role in that mix, which is unfortunate.
So let's jump into the correspondence. And the first one is a very short lived meta bit with Bobby Moynihan coming in as Kim Jong-un. So, Richard, what did you think about this? I'm trying to remember. I think they did a meta thing at some point a couple of years ago, but I can't remember exactly the circumstances. But granted, this only lasted about a minute or so. What did you think of Bobby's brief appearance as Kim Jong-un?
Who's Bobby? I loved this. I thought, and I liked the length of it, and I won't spend more time on it than the piece itself. I thought it was really fun, really great, very meta, but appropriately meta, really fun, nice button to it. And it was all about energy. You needed Bobby Moynihan. You could not have done this sketch with someone playing Kim Jong-un in a more sedated way, or it would have sort of just sat there. I thought it was really funny, and I wouldn't say you can sort of repeat it again, but I liked it a lot. I thought it was great.
Yeah, and I'm glad with how short-lived it was too. I was afraid that they were going to drag out the bit for like an entire 2 or 3 minutes, but I'm glad it was just like a minute done. He got out of there. It was a very clean joke.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's talk about Michael Che's neighbor Willie.
I mean, this was really. Oh, boy. I thought I was going to say this was the biggest clunker of Weekend Update because I had no idea what was around the corner for me. But I think there's really not a lot to say on this other than I just thought it missed. I didn't think it worked for me. Great energy from Keenan. The joke was very repetitive. Che didn't add a lot to it. And I think if someone said to me they thought it was funny, I'd say good for you. I'm glad it worked for someone. But yeah, it just kind of didn't work for me.
Yeah, this is another one in the categories of it was entertaining to watch, but not necessarily funny. I did like a couple of lines. I think his best time he quoted someone is when he said, it's like my pastor said, you can't sleep here, Willie. I think that was the one quote that I really enjoyed. I like the concept of the character, that it's this like eternal optimist who's clearly put into this horrible situation. But I agree, it did get a little repetitive as much as Keenan was trying to sell it. And I agree again, Che did not make it better. But let's move to the crux of Weekend Update. Let's get the oh boy meter out here, because it is the return of Garth and Kat.
Boy.
I think you set a record with that one.
Boy. Was this piece 17 minutes long? This was, I thought, intolerable. I mean, I love Fred Armisen. It was nice to see him back. But even when I fast forwarded through this sketch the second time, it went on forever in fast forward mode. I just don't get it. I still don't get it. And I thought Michael Che really made it even harder to sit through, not because it's his fault, but because he just sort of just was, he was playing. He was the understudy that was filling in for the lead actor who was out sick that night. I don't even know what to say other than,
Yeah, this is definitely in the Californians realm of like, these are characters that the cast really loves doing, so we're just going to bring it out whenever they get there, which is a detriment to us in the audience. I'm sure it might be funnier if you're in the audience actually watching it, because the humor does a little Stefan-esque in that it comes from Kristen Wiig breaking and then obviously making it up as it goes along, but it does not translate well across the screen, especially, again, we talk about this Mad Libs comedy. Even though it's improvised, it's the exact same thing every single time.
Oh, every single time. I don't understand when they announce Garth and Kat and the audience goes crazy with excitement. I just stare dumbfounded at the screen. I want to punch every person in the audience for excitedly applauding. I'm like, no, you're sending the wrong message. Sit there stone face in silence. That's what we need. This needs to be cut at dress. That should be the name of the next Garth and Kat album, should be Cut at Dress. I just thought, oh, I don't know what else to say, because it just really just it's borderline infuriating for me that these two get more screen time. And that was a lot of screen time that they had. So, you know, something got cut for that. And I don't get it.
So let's cool Rich down by actually turning up the heat a little bit. And we're going to go to A Very Cuban Christmas.
Yeah, I think the boy continues. This was a real sort of a lull in the show. I really like the energy of Taron Killam doing Pitbull. I think this was funny. But I got to say, in a weird nod and a backhanded compliment, I thought the funniest gag of the whole thing was Beck Bennett as Fidel Castro dressed up as Santa Claus with the stick raising his hand. That was a beautiful sight gag that really played well. Other than that, you know, McKinnon comes in and does a great job as the American swimmer Diana Nyad. But overall, this was just kind of a weird hodgepodge of mini sketches kind of threaded together. Felt a little bit like how we used to do the opening, the CNN. I always blank on that Piers guy's Morgan. Name. Yeah, the Piers Morgan, which was like four different sketches stitched together. So a couple of funny lines, but I feel like coming off Garth and Kat, I should have just kept fast forwarding and just kept going.
Well, surprisingly, there was Signy in this, but not from Amy Adams. But I would, yeah. I would agree with you. I think, you know, I talked a lot about heightening in this podcast so far, but I think it goes to say, I mean, a key facet to every sketch or every improv scene you do is heightening correctly. And I think they went down the Diana Nyad path, and they went down a little bit with Cuba Gooding Jr. of like, they started to go of like things that are loosely associated with Cuba. I think that would have been a really fun route to go. But you know, I didn't really like throwing in Jorge Garcia from Lost as much as a Lost fan I am, or you know, Kyle Mooney as Scarface, or the Gloria Estefan stuff. Like I agree, I think it was a hodgepodge. The highlight for me was definitely the Fidel Castro thing. I agree, though. I think the concept of the Cuba Gooding Jr. thing was pretty funny as well.
It also was a weird miss for me, and I want to spend a lot of time on it, but it was a weird miss for me in that last week in the Weekend Update, they made a joke about how Cuba Gooding Jr. will do anything for money. And then in this one, they make a point of having Cuba Gooding Jr. say, I'm not even getting paid for this. So I felt like we haven't even, as a group of writers, we haven't even settled on the caricature of Cuba Gooding Jr. in the world of SNL. So weird, weird across the board for me.
It's going to be the year of Uber and Cuba Gooding Jr. on SNL.
Exactly.
You heard it here first.
Exactly.
So let's move on. And I'm really interested to get your opinions on this next sketch, Rich. This is A Magical Christmas.
Yeah, this was, this is an interesting, and I kind of, I'm always intrigued by these sketches. It's always a very dangerous high wire you walk when it's like, what is this sketch? What are they doing? And sometimes you have a payoff that really lands, and sometimes you have a payoff that doesn't. The first time I saw this sketch, I liked it. I don't know that I would say I loved it, but I liked it. The second time I watched this sketch, I really liked it. And I just it was one of those sketches for me that just kind of paid off in a way that to then go back and see it again, knowing that they were raccoons, it was just perfect for me. I thought it was just really funny. So yeah, I really liked it.
I completely agree. I think SNL is going to be able to benefit from the viral factor nowadays. You know, back in the 70s, you put it on, you might have taped it, but otherwise you watched it live, and there was no YouTube, there was no next day things where you could watch the sketch again. They can really benefit from having these surprise endings happen, and now you're able to go back and rewatch it under the context that they are raccoons, as you just talked about, Rich. And I completely agree. When it started off and they were specifically the line, you know, like, how do we look? Did we look the way we're supposed to? I'm like, oh, are they aliens? I was waiting for them to quickly reveal that they were aliens. And then when it turned out that they were raccoons who made a Christmas wish to turn into a singing trio to try to get with men, I think it just put... So it was like a Kaiser Soze moment. Like, so many lines came flashing into my head, you know, like, you know, the talking about the garbage, making those weird noises. I really had a lot of fun with this sketch. And the one thing that maybe even the highlight for me was that not the second song, but the first song they did was so like nonsensical, but it made so much sense both to their characters and the era as well. I feel like a lot of those 1940s Christmas songs were kind of nonsense. So to have them just sing a song that was complete nonsense was a lot of fun.
Well, and by the way, what great kudos to them that those songs they did live. I mean, I really watched it, and I do not think that they pre-taped those. I think that they did those live. I mean, just really the patter of it all, they nailed well. You know, and I think with some of these sketches, sometimes where it can be hard is you're waiting to see what the payoff is, but there's not enough along the way to keep it fun until you get to the payoff. And this was, I thought, a really good job of playing that out, where there were a lot of fun little jokes in there. And huge props to my boy Bobby and also to Kyle Mooney, but really to Bobby. I thought like he was the anchor of keeping this thing like, we didn't make any rules, we don't want you to eat the garbage. Like, he delivered it in a way. So for a sketch, it reminded me in a weird way of Louis C.K. and Vanessa Bayer had done this pajama foreplay sketch where it was like very stylized, very weird, but fun along the way. But that never really paid off. It was just like, no, that was weird. This had a payoff. And I appreciate it. I thought they did a really good job and really solid here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like the couple of Bobby Moynihan and Kyle Mooney is slowly growing.
Yeah,
between the cold open last week, I know before the season it seemed like Bobby had a bromance with Taryn, and you know, Kyle was tight with Beck Bennett, but it seems like we're doing a little bit of cross-pollination here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought that I always enjoyed Bobby and Taryn Killam, and they're rarely in a scene bandying about. But him and, you know, in a way, it was interesting because when Bobby used to be in sketches with Taryn, Taryn was the anchor and Bobby was the foil. And now we're seeing it sort of switch where Bobby's playing a more senior role and getting to do a little bit more of the heavy lifting. And I'm really liking it because I think Mooney plays well off Bobby as opposed to Bobby having to play off the other person. So. Definitely, I think we'll see more of them together in 2015.
Exactly. So let's move into yet another cherry-picked recurring sketch from the Charlize Theron episode.
Yeah.
It's Whiskers Are We.
Yeah, very odd that we're seeing it a second time. I would say, again, I don't know that I loved this sketch. I actually liked it better the second time. There were a lot of jokes that didn't land here. But it is the kind of stuff I like seeing at 12:55 a.m. Just a weird sketch, live animals being kind of funny and cute, a couple of jokes that absolutely really did land, weird, strong character choices. So even though a couple of jokes really didn't land and it was probably too long, I liked it, and again just to get some Kate McKinnon in again was just great. I thought these two were really good together.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say Kate McKinnon and in part Cecily Strong have become the queens of the 12:55 sketch. They've just like, between the porn stars and even like the sex hotline stuff, you know, Kate McKinnon stuff was fun to do. Like, I think the two of them have just consistently done well. And I used to call Will Forte the 12:55 guy just because all the stuff he did was always pushed back then. And it was so weird, but he does such a great job at it. And I would argue that it's the same case for Kate and Cecily right now.
No, she does. And again, whether it's coming in and closing with Justin Bieber or Diana, whatever name is the swimmer, or just playing the weird character, I feel like she's got such a great tone. So when she's talking about Toby the cat, that's the narcissist, but then she tags it with, I guess I'm the dumb one for giving him power of attorney. Like, that's a line that I really don't think many other people could deliver so perfectly. That sort of deadpan, but still weird, very perfect. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, and I think you exactly proved that point when you kind of counterpointed to Amy Adams, who did not have a lot of laugh lines, despite the fact that they were written in. They just didn't land so well. Like, even her line of, you know, Toby goes on long walks and we don't know where, he doesn't tell us where he's been. Like, it didn't land too well. Kate brought it home again with the whole thing about how Toby came home with an Adam Lambert wristband.
Yeah, and not to say that it was Amy's bad, but those are so hard. Those are such hard jokes to sell when you're just doing weird and you're not leaning into the joke as much as you're trying to sell it as real, that it takes someone like Kate to really do a great job.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to the goodbyes, I wanted to touch briefly. Rich, did you see the Cut for Time sketch this week?
I did. There was two of them, I think. Yes, I did see them.
Oh, I only saw the one. So if you want to talk about the other one, the one that I saw was the Pete Davidson Love Actually spoof.
Yeah, I kind of see why it was cut for time. I thought it was a really good idea. I like Pete Davidson. I think he's got a lot of charisma. For those who didn't see it, it was basically a sketch where he shows up on Amy Adams' doorstep, and because her husband is home, he puts on music, and he's got written on what are basically cue cards a couple of things. And while it's supposed to be romantic, it just gets weird in a lot of different and funny ways. I kind of see why it was cut. I would rather have seen that than Girlfriend's Talk Show, but there's no way you're cutting that sketch. It probably was even better than A Very Cuban Christmas, but timing wise, it was so off. I don't think you could have done that. I think that the idea of it, and again, I know most of the people listening probably didn't see it. The idea of doing the flip cards, I don't think Pete could really pull that off. I'm a big fan, back in the day, Zach Galifianakis and his stand-up used to do great bits with flip charts and stuff written in this way. Dimitri Martin mm-hmm. is very famous for doing a great job, but it takes a lot of preparation. The music has to be right. The timing of the beats has to be really specific. It's got to build in certain ways. There's got to be more visual jokes than just words. I can see why this was cut. A great attempt, but I can see why it was cut.
Yeah, I would agree. I was staring at the card so much I didn't even notice Pete Davidson's expressions till the second half. I feel like he could have sold it a little bit more, but I completely agree with you about the way it should have been paced. I mean, he was tearing through those cards at almost a completely even tone until that second half. I would say post pictures of dancing skeletons, I think it was when he really found it. And I did like the moment that made Amy Adams break. It's clear it was a Stefan moment where she did not expect to see that.
I think so too. I think you're right. I think they swapped it at the last second, which I really appreciate. It was very fun.
So I'm intrigued. What was the other cut sketch that you saw?
It was a pre-tape sketch. I'm pretty sure it was a Good Neighbor pre-tape piece because Kyle Mooney was in it, and it was I won't remember the name of it, but it was a commercial for action figure sets of the nativity scene done as kind of like action figure destruction, kind of like Transformers. So it was playing with like Jesus and Mary and baby Jesus as if they were like battling bad guys and stuff, and it was a really cute idea, but similar to what I was saying before about the cereal sketch, it kind of had no point of view other than it was like, oh, imagine if people took the nativity characters and made them into action figures in like a classic, Saturday morning cartoon kind of way, but it didn't really have a point of view to it. So it kind of just sat there. Good attempt, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up. I don't think there's been a lot of Good Neighbor stuff for the past few weeks. Seems to be there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor, so it'll be interesting to see these guys have a few weeks until the next show, or it'll be interesting to see how they're able to use the break to kind of clean up and see if they can get some more stuff on the air.
Yeah, I'm not feeling the Lonely Island, the Good Neighbor stuff as much as you are. I would like to be proven wrong. Nothing would make me happier than to be watching the Christmas episode of 2015 saying, boy, these guys are anchoring the show and these pieces are brilliant. But I'm just not feeling it today.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens in the hiatus. But let's move to Rich's best analysis of the evening. Perhaps it is the goodbyes.
Yeah, well, again, for the goodbyes, a big letdown for me. Not that I'm mad, but I was definitely let down that it was at Studio 8H. You know, I always love the old tradition from the show of doing the good nights of the Christmas episode down at the Rockefeller Center skating rink and skating around. We haven't seen that since Jimmy Fallon in 2011. So it's been a couple of years. Even Jimmy Fallon last year didn't do it. And they had done it, I think, in like 2005 and 2006. So I'm always disappointed when we don't get to see them skating around because I think it's sort of fun. A very quick goodbye from Amy Adams. I think they were pressed for time. So she was very awkward, but I think that they were like, you have 10 seconds or something like that is my guess. Other than that, fun. She seemed to, sort of hang first with Kristen Wiig and with the One Direction guys, but watching it on Hulu, she did sort of mix in and say goodbye to everyone. Again, nothing got my blood boiling than that a-hole Mike Myers not showing up. It drove me. That annoyed me more than Garth and Kat doing a 28-minute piece on Weekend Update. I was so annoyed at Mike Myers for not being there.
Yeah, good job, Rich. You just lost a key role in Shrek 5 because of your words.
You're right. I should have just kept my mouth shut like a good lieutenant. my favorite moment, though, was just there was a point where Bobby Moynihan sees Kristen Wiig and they give each other a huge bear hug that just like you could feel the love through the television screen. It was such a wonderful moment. So nice energy. Good goodbyes. Everyone, I think, is excited for the long break. So and I think everyone had to be fairly proud of this episode. So I feel like we all went out on a good note.
So, to wrap things up, I would love to just launch into a couple of questions, discussion points about this first half of the season. And I'll start with something that Taylor Cotter brought up to Rich and I, an article from The Nerdist. And
yes,
I believe the title says the current Saturday Night Live cast is strong as ever, just not as an ensemble. Now, I think a lot of people have said, specifically, on the internet, have gone on to say that, like, this seems to be a very strong run of episodes. At least they seem to have bounced back from kind of that gap year last year after losing all those greats. Rich, what do you think about the first half of the season in general? And would you agree with this article title? Do you think that while things are going well, the Saturday Night Live ensemble isn't really an ensemble at this point?
I don't want to say it as strongly as they made the case, but I hadn't really thought about it till I read the article and I thought, I actually think they're kind of right about this, because when I think about new characters and new reoccurring sketches, I can't think of a team of I enjoy seeing those two SNL cast members together doing those characters other than the porn stars, at 12:55 at night, which has now been going on for a number of years. When we talk about seeing Garth and Kat and then come back and just having that chemistry of the two of them, or thinking back of, Stefan and Seth Meyers, I would agree that I don't think that there's any, if there's going to be a character that I want to see again or a sketch that I wouldn't mind repeating, I can't think of a single time where I would say, oh, it's because those two have such good chemistry.
Mm-hmm. I would say that I agree that, like, I wouldn't go as far to say that, like, they're not an ensemble, but I would say that a lot of partnerships and groupings are starting to emerge. And I we touched upon this with the Magical Christmas sketch, with the new partnership of Bobby and Kyle Mooney emerging. I would say that in general, I feel like the female cast is very tightly bonded, even though they vary greatly in style. You can see that from the Back Home Ballers sketch and even Let's Do It in My Twin Bed, that, like, I think they gel well together as a group. You have your Kate and Cecily as well. You have your Vanessa and Cecily. I think there are definitely partnerships that are starting to emerge, and I agree. I don't think anyone's like shipping the Bobby Moynihan Vanessa Bayer pairing. We typically don't see them together in sketches. So I would say, like, something that I would like to see in 2015 would be more sketches that really mix those characters up, just because I do feel like, as awesome as the show has and like been in putting a lot of new things out there this half season, they've been starting to fall into a little bit of like, let's put these people together and let's just kind of have that sit. So I would love to see, you know, it's an ensemble for a reason. I would like to see more partnerships between people.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like, you know, when you're bringing it up, I thought there was a point, you know, even as late as last year, where I thought that Adi Bryant and Kate McKinnon were just starting to become a real power duo, probably, you know, when they did Dyke and Fats, the police parody. I thought they had such good energy together, but we're really not seeing it. We're not seeing them together very often other than all female group pieces. So, yeah, it's a good question. I would like to see more sketches where it's really strong pairing. So hopefully we'll see more of that next year.
All right, Rich, give me a couple or a few hosts that you would predict will be doing something and will be hosting in the back half of this season.
It's a good, you know, I am infamously bad at this. My track record of predicting, other than predicting alumni, is probably pretty bad these days. I feel like, even though technically Chris Rock and Sarah Silverman were alumni, we've really only had one alumni host this year so far, which is Bill Hader. So I'm really hoping that as we get into the final season of Parks and Rec, we get Amy Poehler back. Mm-hmm. I think that we're due for that. I think that would be really nice. I think Will Ferrell coming back would be nice. I'd love to see him. I really want to see Bruno Mars come back. I don't know when his next album is out, so I don't know. I mean, I know he's, for whatever reason, Mark Ronson is getting the credit for that Bruno Mars song that was written by Mark Ronson, and Mark Ronson plays rhythm guitar in the background of Badly. But I'd love to see Bruno Mars come back. I think that would be great. What I don't know is, I can't tell you who's got the big movies or who's kind of probably going to be on the publicity run that would make sense for them to host. But to me, it's always a party when we have alumni host. I'd love to see some of them come back.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a little staggering at this point, actually, that we have yet to see a dual musical guest this season at all. And I think Bruno Mars is way overdue, especially since he made such big waves when he first hosted in the fall of 2012. I'll just throw a few names out there because I just quickly looked up a list of movies that were coming out in 2015. I don't know if you know this person, Rich. There is a teenage actress by the name of Shailene Woodley.
Sure.
Yeah. So she's I think the newest movie of the Divergent series is coming out. And I think, you know, they've been grabbing Jennifer Lawrence. They've been grabbing Josh Hutcherson. They've been grabbing Woody Harrelson in for these movies. I think Shailene Woodley would be like a nice person to add as well. May is going to be coming up on the Avengers, so I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Robert Downey Jr. hosted episode. I'm trying to remember when the last time he hosted something was.
That's a good question. Yeah.
And I was just looking at some other movies. Channing Tatum has a movie that's coming out in early February. I think it's been a couple years since he's hosted, and clearly, as the Jump Street movies have shown, he has a good comedy game. Cate Blanchett is going to be in that Cinderella movie as well. And Pitch Perfect 2 is coming out, and we probably won't get Anna Kendrick since she hosted last year, but I would not be surprised if we got a Rebel Wilson hosted episode.
That's interesting. I think that could be interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing Elizabeth Banks host. I think she's hosted before, but yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing her come back. I had thought about Channing Tatum when you brought it up. I think he's due. He had a nice outing the last time, and I think he could do it. He could do a nice job again. So nice to see him back.
So we'll see if Rich and I go 0-9 in the pool. Coming up January 17th, I believe Kevin Hart makes his return. Rich, how do you feel about the return of Kevin Hart?
I'm a little underwhelmed by Kevin Hart coming back. Probably not fair to say, but I don't remember him doing anything that sort of left me all that excited to see him come back. But we'll see. I'm open.
Yeah, the only thing I actually remember from the Kevin Hart episode is the Z shirt sketch, which is probably the most prevalent thing that Tim O'Brien did.
Mike O'Brien.
What's his name?
Oh, no. Tim Robinson.
Tim Robinson. I'm sorry, Tim Robinson. I totally forgot your name. Just like the most impactful thing that Tim Robinson did the entire season he was on.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree.
All right. So I guess we'll start closing the book here on the first half of SNL season 40. Rich, how are you feeling right now? Are you excited to move into the back half? Are you excited for the 40th anniversary show? That should be coming up in a couple months, right?
It's in February. I think it's mid-February, February 15th or something like that. So, yeah, that'll be great. And I'm sure, by the way, it won't be good, but it will be great. And I'm really looking forward to it.
So if you guys have any comments, feel free to reach out to us. You have a myriad of ways here. You can always, as Rich talked about before, post comments below this video on postshowrecaps.com. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to the Saturday Night Live only feed. I know Rob and Rich will be gone for a few weeks, but if you guys want to listen back, if you miss their magical voices, you can always listen back and make sure to rate and review that because it helps bump it up in the general iTunes ratings. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. You can find Rich at Rich Tack like a thumbtack on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I am at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. Special thanks, by the way, to everyone who was able to send in some last minute questions. Jeremiah Panhorst, Sue Hawkeye, the great Johnny DeSilvera, Taylor Cotter, Meg, with a dollar sign after her name. Thank you all for submitting some great questions. I'm as an SNL nerd, Rich, this was fantastic to come on and talk with you. I loved nerding out with you about this. So thank you for making this such an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, it's very fun having you. I really appreciate you stepping in and did a great job. It was great doing it together.
So Post Show Recaps is kind of winding down for this calendar year. We've wrapped up Sons of Anarchy, Walking Dead, Once Upon a Time, American Horror Story. Justified is still being covered right now. I believe Josh Wigler and Antonio Mazzaro are still covering it. Who knows? They had a lot to drink at that office Christmas party. They might have they might still be picking out the pine leaves out of their skin after they tackled it. But Come mid-January, of course, Rob and Rich will be back covering the Kevin Hart episode. We might have some more one-time coverage for you guys before we jump headfirst into everything. So thank you guys so much for listening. If you finish, use the hashtag PSRecaps, hashtag SNL to let us know that you finished. I speak on behalf of Rob, on behalf of Rich, on behalf of everyone at Post Show Recaps when I say have a very happy holidays. Thank you so much for your continued investment in this, and Rob and Rich will see you in the new year. Take care.
Enjoy everybody. The break.
Exactly. Take care, everyone. Sing some Garth and Kat songs if they pop into your head. Just don't sing it too loud or Rich will hear you.
I'll oh boy you via Twitter.
And with that, oh boy, that's going to be the end of everything. Take care,
bye-bye.
Everyone. Bye.
Bye.